gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Galindi, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. I just got back from the annual NAMM convention down in Anaheim, California. I survived. I saw some cool stuff. More importantly, I got to hang out with some amazing friends. And I'm trying to think what the highlights were. Of course, Waterloo had an Archtop guitar. Everybody was talking about that, wondering how much it was going to be. Fender had the Acoustasonic guitar, sort of their acoustic Telecaster that does some modeling inside of it. That was okay. I didn't really get to hear that one plugged in or try it out, but I got to see it up close. Gibson was back with a vengeance. Time will tell, but the guitars that they had on display at NAMM were some of the most impressive Gibson guitars I've ever seen. They have nailed the sort of light relicking look on some of their electrics. They had a Trini Lopez model that looked incredible. And then they had Trini Lopez himself. That was amazing that Gibson, yes, giant Gibson guitars, could care enough about things to bring back Trini Lopez. I thought that was a good omen. And what else can I tell you? Loudon Guitars has a new imprint with Ed Sheeran, which you probably know about. Taylor Guitars unveiled the Grand Pacific, which we're going to be talking about with Andy Powers on this podcast in just a week or two. The Grand Pacific is sort of their worn-in, dreadnought-ish, sort of the Taylor for people who maybe are a little more traditional than Taylor Guitars. It is a very cool guitar. We've had a couple of them here at the office for about a month now. Anyways, I survived NAMM. I had a lot of fun. It was great to see everybody there. It was great to get all the feedback on the Fretboard Journal podcast, as well as the Luthier on Luthier podcast that we host, and even the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast that I now host with Skip Simmons. You know, I've gotten more feedback and emails on that podcast with Skip Simmons, the new one that we've done, than I've ever gotten about pretty much anything we've ever done here. I'll take it. It's great. It's all good feedback. Folks are loving it. We are going to post episode 4 of that podcast very soon, so subscribe to it if you haven't yet over on iTunes. And more importantly, submit your amp questions to us over at fretboardjournal@gmail.com. I will read them to Skip, and then he will go off on them, which is kind of the format for the whole show. It is a good one. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to our dear friend Bob Minner. Bob has been touring alongside country superstar Tim McGraw since before Tim McGraw was a country superstar. He is an insanely talented multi-instrumentalist and acoustic guitarist, and he has a new album out this week called Six String Sanctuary. It is hymns played on acoustic guitar, and I have to say, as a guy who is not very religious, this is one of the most beautiful acoustic guitar records I have heard in years. I got a download of it, and I wanted to talk to Bob immediately about it. This is just a beautifully recorded and beautifully played record that I think anyone who is into great acoustic guitar music would love. So check that out. You can look up Bob Minner, M-I-N-N-E-R, online, and I'm sure you'll find links for it. What else can I tell you? Another news, the Fretboard Journal 43 is mailing to everybody right now, or at least everyone who has subscribed. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do so immediately. Use the coupon code PODCAST. We would love to have you join the Fretboard Journal tribe. Billy Strings is in this issue, Molly Tuttle, Rory Hoffman, Loudon Guitars, and a lot more. It is a truly fun issue. A lot of our readers are saying it is one of their favorite issues we've ever put out. And we are hard at work on issue 44 now, which will be wrapping up and leaving the printer in late March. So we are well on our way with that issue, and that one is looking to be a lot of fun too. So subscribe, please. Not much else to report. If anyone is interested in sponsoring this podcast, please reach out to me at jason@fretboardjournal.com. We are also taking sponsorships for the other podcasts I mentioned, but we'd love to help you share your story on this podcast. We know from experience, and we have some case studies, that a lot of folks who listen to this show buy a lot of guitars, especially the guitars that I mentioned. Anyways, that's all my plugs for today. Head on over to fretboardjournal.com if you want to see more photos from NAMM. I just posted a bunch. And here's my conversation with Bob Minner. Once again, the name of the album is Six String Sanctuary.
So, Bob, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Hey, Jason, thanks for having me. It's great to visit with you again.
Yeah. So, since we last talked, you have a new record out. But before we get to all that fun stuff, for folks who maybe don't know your story, you've been playing with Tim McGraw for how many years now?
26 years as his acoustic guy.
Okay, that's a long run for any touring musician, about as long as it gets, I'd say.
Well, the only other guy in town that I know of, and he's a good buddy, is Bill Cooley, who plays acoustic for Kathy Mattea. And I think he's going on 29 or 30 with her. So, yeah, it's been a great run.
So you obviously are in addition to being a great guitarist, you're easy to get along with. Tim has no problems with you. You don't have any substance abuse problems, and you're on time, I'm guessing.
You know, it's really weird with road gigs like that. You know, of course you have to be able to play and bring it when that time comes. But man, so much of it is just being able to get along with people and just doing your job, you know? And so he's not tired of me yet, you know.
Good.
So I guess maybe eventually he will be, but knock on wood, hopefully not anytime soon.
Okay. And for folks who don't know, where did you grow up? Where did you come from?
I grew up in a little rural town about 60 miles south of St. Louis, in a little town called DeSoto, which was a train town. And really, our two claims to country music fame was the country music comedian Duke of Paducah.
Okay.
And George Jones actually lived in DeSoto for a really short while when he was younger. How he ended up there, I have no idea, but it's a verified thing. And just a really, you know, small town in Missouri, but just a lot of great music exposure growing up. So, yeah. That's where I call home.
And was did you ever come from a family of musicians?
Well, you know, my dad played clawhammer banjo.
Okay.
When I was about five, I remember a guy when we were living in St. Louis at that time when I was young. I remember a guy coming over to our apartment. His name was Jim Olin, and I think he was like a field recorder for St. Louis University or Smithsonian, doing some stuff with it and recording, you know, string band music and fiddle music along the Missouri River and the Mississippi, which has its own thing. And he would come over and had this old S.S. Stewart open back, and he would give my dad clawhammer lessons. And so, you know, my youth was spent in stuff like, you know, Wade Ward and Kyle Creed and all these wonderful string bands. So that's kind of how I got started in it all.
Right.
And still love clawhammer to this day.
And when did you take up playing?
About five and a half, six.
Okay.
I remember taking the. I remember my dad would go to work. My mom would let me, you know, hold the banjo on the bed and you know do that thing. And so I would say probably really starting to really take a liking to it. Six and seven was when I really started doing, you know, something that would be regular or have an infatuation at least with it. So pretty young.
Yeah. And did it come pretty naturally to you?
Probably more naturally then than it does now. I just had a lot of exposure, you know, when we moved to that little town, DeSoto, when I was 10, this whole group of just older musicians just kind of blossomed and opened up. And, you know, it was that kind of going to people's houses and, you know, in the wintertime or whatever, and the old ladies putting all this great food out and all the coffee and all the old men in the living room playing this music. And so with their help, I think it kind of came easier. You know, you learn from exposure. You know, and so that's kind of just how it came up. Yeah, so I think it kind of came easy.
All right.
You know, at different times, you know, depending on the music, you know, so, yeah.
And you were kind of, from the get-go, kind of a multi-instrumentalist, right?
Yeah, I guess I kind of follow suit. You know, it seems to be kind of a trend with bluegrassers. It's like, you know, if you play one, chances are you probably play more than one. And, you know, all my friends that I know, they're bluegrassers, you know, they play more than their chosen instrument they're kind of known for. So, yeah, you know, it just kind of blossomed and opened up like that, I guess, because, like, again, you know, the exposure I had, you know, had access, even if I didn't own them, you know, I had access to a mandolin, you know, I'd go over and mess with that. And then my future wife, Ginger, her uncle, Doug, was just a really great old-time fiddle player, and he kind of got me started at fiddle. And it was a long time before I actually owned a fiddle, but, you know, I'd go over there and do that with him. And so, you know, and eventually acquired, you know, the instruments. But, yeah, it seems to be a thing that if you play one, you play more than one. But, yeah, I'm kind of settled in on acoustic, I think, now.
You're backwards from everyone I know. Everybody I know has like 20 guitars and can barely play one. You're playing all these instruments. You don't even own most of them.
Well, you know, I think I practice more now. You know, I'll be 53 in February. And I think I practice more now than I ever have. And, you know, so and on whatever instrument, you know. I think as you get older, I think it's just natural. You know, when you're young, you have your hands are supple and fingers are nimble, and your mind is open to, you know, all different kinds of music and learning, and kind of sponge it all in. I think as you get older, things start slowing down, and I'm certainly feeling that. You know, I think everybody does if they're honest about it. You know, when you get into your 50s, the hands maybe don't do what they used to, and the speed kind of goes a little bit. And you just kind of learn to adapt. And I think part of that adaptation is just kind of staying consistent on a practice schedule. So I think I practice more now than I ever did. I don't know if I'm getting any better, but at least I'm putting the effort in.
How varied, I mean, I've been behind the scenes at these Tim McGraw shows and seen how big the circus tent is, and it's quite big. There's quite a lot of players. How much do those shows vary from town to town or night to night?
You know, with our show, we're really consistent. You know, I've been in rehearsals for a week and a half, and working up a new show for this year. This will be a fairs and festivals year, I believe. And so, you know, there's some new songs we're working on. And really, you know, what we try to do is build a show. And because of the type of show it is, you know, it's consistent from night to night. You know, there's a lot going on in my ear molds, you know, that maybe the audience doesn't hear, you know, maybe a click track or a segue, the way it's laid out, to kind of keep the show consistent from night to night. And you kind of have to do that, I guess, when you have a bigger show like that is that type of entertainment, where you have not only the music, but you might also have video content that has to be consistent every night. And then, of course, the lighting, you know, who's hitting what spot or wherever. So with that show, it's pretty consistent night to night. You know, we might, you know, if Tim wants to do something off the cuff, you know, we'll hit the pause button and then he'll do whatever he wants to do. But generally it's pretty consistent, you know?
Yeah. How many guitars are you taking out?
Well, this would be two rigs this year, A rig and B rig. It'll comprise of each rig will have, three acoustics, one rezzo and one banjo. So that'll be my rig for this year. And that's pretty standard issue for me, you know. I have a couple Collings out for the A rig, and then a Waterloo for Humble and Kind, Sullivan banjo, and then and then one of Paul Beard's resonators. I've been using his stuff for what seems like forever, and it's just really great. And so Yeah, not as much as some, but, you know, still a lot to keep up with. You know, I've got a really good tech. My tech, Nick Wick, is his name, and he's just really, he's been with me for like maybe 12 or 13 years, and he always has them, you know, handed off to me in tune and ready to go. So, you know, that makes it a lot easier. So, yeah. Maybe not as much as some, but still a handful.
So you got two rigs. I'm assuming one is in one part of the country and the other is somewhere else, so you can fly over stretches of the country. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, in fact, we're starting this whole February 3rd. We have the second and third, we have a show, well, the first and second, rather. We have a show in Atlantic City, and that'll be on one rig, and then we're doing something with a Super Bowl thing, wherever that's going to be, in Atlanta. And so, yeah, two rigs. And I think that's kind of common with this kind of, you know, with this kind of touring that I'm involved in with country or,
yeah,
you know, other pop acts, yeah.
Yeah, and
so you just have to.
Yeah, and what, are the rigs identical? Do you try to have, like, the exact same model guitar in each, or does that not really fly?
Not really, you know. I mean, as long as you're consistent with, you know, trying to, you know, capture the essence of what you're doing on your main rig, you know, then you can kind of vary a little bit. Of course, you know, no two guitars are alike, and, you know, but what we try to do is with the A rig, you know, we've been on that for a week, and so now, in fact, tonight when I go to rehearsal, we're switching over to B rig. And as long as you get your tones up and, you know, we run the show and everybody's happy with their mix, it can really vary. It doesn't have to be exact. You know, I just kind of like having different sounds in my ears on different rigs.
Sure.
You know, it kind of makes it adventurous and kind of brings maybe a different texture or sound to a song, you know, different than the other rig. And I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. I got to ask. With all the infrastructure there, all the redundancy, does anything horrible still happen? Does anything break? Are you ever sweating bullets at these Tim McGraw shows?
You know, sweating bullets. Well, you know, yeah, there's a couple of, you know, tightrope over alligators moments, you know, for me. And, you know, like when we start Humble and Kind, which is like Tim's, you know, it's a huge song for him, and it starts on acoustic, you know, I'm carrying the ball on it. And it's like, you know, if there's a segue that's coming into it, you know, just making sure the guitar is in tune, you know, because there's just like nothing worse than, you know, starting a song, you know, and you're the, like, it's just you.
Yeah.
And then the guitar being out, and there's just nothing you can do except, you know, bite down hard and try to get through it. So, yeah, you know, or, you know, if you have a power outage, you know, sometimes that's happened. Sometimes buildings just lose their power and that'll go out. But, you know, we've been doing, all of us have been doing this for kind of long enough. We're pretty good at improvisation and things like that. You know, I think, you know, I don't know where that comes from. I guess just doing it so much. But yeah, being out of tune, that's the worst.
Got it. Yeah, I can imagine. So it's the same for anyone, whether you're playing at a coffee house for three people or for 30,000.
Well, yeah, you know, but, you know, if I'm out of tune, it's just so many more people get to hear it, and, you know, and they'll rip me about it, you know, but I'll rip some of the other guys for out too. So it's kind of just, it's just good old brotherly, you know, ribbon, but it's embarrassing because I want to try and deliver the best I can, but, you know, sometimes circumstances are such, you know, that, you know, and at least it's not carrying, you know, a vintage D18 or herringbone and, you know, having it crushed by some stagehand tripping over it, you know, 15 minutes before the show. So yeah. It could always be worse.
It could be worse, yeah. And these gigs are, I mean, it seems to me from the outsider's perspective, they seem pretty nonstop. Are there breaks between Tim McGraw concert, you know, tours?
You know, yeah. I mean, you know, the way it works now is like this year, we'll probably, I don't know how many we got, maybe 35 or so. I'm home most of the week, you know, and so that's not too bad. And then sometimes you'll hit a run where you're out for a couple of weeks straight, and that brings its own challenges of just being away from home. And when you're younger, I guess, you know, when you're younger and you're going to a town that you've never been to before, and you're young, your body can handle all that. You know, that's exciting, but it's like I'm at a point now, I guess, being with him this long, is I'm seeing a lot of the same places for the umpteenth time, you know, and really the battle, you know, I make the joke that, you know, what they're paying me for is not really, it's not really paying for the plane. It's just the travel, you know, it's the discipline of packing a suitcase and living out of it and, you know, living out of a hotel. And so, and again, that's where the practice comes in. It's easier to have a guitar in the room and put some effort into playing and practicing, you know. But, like, other than that, I'm home probably on a busy season 3 days out of the week on, you know, on the average for the main tour season.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think typically with most guys that tour like this, you know, it'll pick up February and March, and then you'll get busy through the summer, and, you know, then it'll taper off about August or so, or September. And so that, you know, because if we're doing, especially if we're doing stuff like amphitheaters, you know, I'm always amazed at how amphitheaters just have all the different acts. It's almost like a circuit. You know, you might have, you know, Dave Matthews in St. Louis the night before us, but then he's in maybe Kansas City, you know, ahead of us or whatever. It's amazing how they circle all that around. But yeah, it could be worse. You know, I used to tour a lot more. In fact, the first year I was with Tim, I think Ginger cataloged, and this is not just show days, this is like just being gone from the house. I think I was gone 300 days the first year.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore, you know. So I don't think we're going to do
that. Yeah, and she was still home when you got back. That's great.
Amazingly so. Yeah, you know. But, yeah, 300 days was the first year with Tim. Because he just took off like a rocket, you know, in the country market. And you know, and an interesting story about that was we had booked for Tim's, at that time, I guess, booking agent or manager or whatever, we were doing clubs and other stuff, you know, maybe a barbecue festival or whatever, where he was just kind of like, didn't really have a hit. And we had all these shows booked. And then Don't Take the Girl and Indian Outlaw came out. And then all of a sudden, you know, he's got two big hits under his belt. And I think how the story went is that whoever was doing the booking or whatever back then said, you know, I can get you out of these smaller clubs and in these days and, you know, get you into these bigger things. We'll just do those. And Tim was like, no, you booked them. We're going to work, you know, which I think was, you know, really smart because, you know, if you have a club that seats 500 people or so or whatever, and you have a hit, you know, we found out real quick that, you know, there'd be maybe 1,000 people outside the door trying to get in, mm-hmm. which is good for business. So we just doubled down and we worked what was already booked and then all of the new stuff they booked them for. So yeah, it was a busy year, but it was the right thing to do. So, and I'm still married. So
yeah. Well, yeah. Speaking of downtime, you're not just a couch potato when you aren't on the road because you just recorded, well, I don't know when you recorded it, but you just put out a new record and it's incredible. And, it's called Six String Sanctuary. Don't make me say that five times fast.
But, oh, come on.
But tell us about it.
Well, you know, the album, you know, it's a collection of just acoustic hymns, and I had actually I did it here at the house, and I actually scrapped the whole thing, like recorded it and scrapped it like two or three times, because I just didn't, you know, I just didn't like it.
You didn't like your playing, that, or you were questioning the whole concept?
Oh, the playing, yeah. You know, and you know, I just, probably like a lot of other guys, I just tend to be my worst critic and just think it's absolutely, you know, awful, you know. And I think, you know, the continuity of it, it was just like, man, it's just, that's just not right. You know, it doesn't feel right. And really a lot of it was just a matter of stripping stuff down, you know. And this whole thing with the hymns record is one of those things that kind of stemmed from growing up, again, in that, you know, that little rural town in Missouri. You know, when I was 10 years old, this has to do with the record, if you'll give me the time.
I assumed it did. Go for it.
A slightly longer story, but don't mean to bore you. But when I was 10 years old, I opened up, thanks to my next-door neighbor, her dad was opening up like this carpet and home improvement store, Smitty's Home Decorating. And so they needed some local talent. So, you know, I got to play banjo and guitar on the local AM radio station, KJD. And my mom actually still, and gave it to me, actually still has the Memorex cassette of that, the whole thing.
Nice.
You know, and so that led me to like hooking up with this bluegrass gospel group in the town right next to DeSoto, Festus, Missouri. And there was this guy named Bill Key, and he went by the name Phil and Lily Key and the Ozark Gospel Singers. It's like, you know, that was his persona. And I remember going over, and on Tuesday nights, again, you know, with all these other older gentlemen and this lady, we'd record on half-inch, you know, Boss Tex tape. In this shed, he had converted to this, like, little recording studio. We'd record this half-hour gospel show for, you know, whatever stations. And that led to, like, going out and playing these churches. And he had this old classic Bluebird school bus that he had bought and converted, you know, to this, I guess, a touring bus, for lack of a better word, and had all the furniture, like, drywall screwed down and had it all fixed up. You know, and when you're 10 years old, you just think that's, like, the most incredible thing you've ever seen, yeah. You know. Yeah. And so, like, we would do, like, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. And, like, so Friday night might be, like, some Methodist church, and Saturday might be a Baptist church, and Sunday might be, you know, a Pentecostal free-for-all. I mean, you just never knew. So out of that just came all these hymns, you know, that we were either playing or heard through growing up. So this project kind of stemmed from all of that. It was like, I could do a flat picking record or some other, you know, more contemporary stuff I'm trying to work on and figure out and start that. Or, you know, I can just do this hymns project and just kind of give props, you know, to a little bit how I grew up. And then also, you know, these songs that are just what they are, you know, they're just these timeless hymns. And so that's really kind of the concept of how I came about the record.
It's, so I'm not a religious person, but there are a handful of records, and I will count this as one of them, and maybe my favorite of all time was like 25 years ago, Hank Jones and Charlie Hayden did a record of spirituals called Steal Away. This is one of those records like those where you don't need to be religious, like you're just kind of moved by the music. And I'm curious how you went about your interpreting these songs, how you went about arranging them. You know, I wasn't familiar with most of these tunes, but I fell in love with them when I heard you play them. So there's that.
Well, first of all, send me a link when you're done. Send me a link to the Hayden record. I got to hear that.
Okay.
I've not heard that before.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, really, hymns are what they are, there's not really a whole lot of room for, you know, improv on them. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you can play Blackberry Blossom or any other fiddle tune and, you know, improv, you know, till the cows come home on it. And then get back to the head of it. But hymns are kind of like, that's just what they are, you know? And I think from a guitarist standpoint, I think that's kind of the strength of them, is that, you know, you have to discipline yourself to kind of go, okay, you know, I'm not doing this with a band. I'm just going to do this with a solo, you know, a single acoustic. And so, you know, how do you play it where it's recognizable to people who, you know those songs, or maybe grew up with them, or you know them from childhood or whatever? How do you make it relevant to them melody wise, but then also make it, you know, enjoyable for guitar players where they're not bored with the same thing for 3.5 or 4 minutes. So that's kind of the challenge I was faced with. And, you know, really, I just try to just be true to the melodies and embellish a little bit here and there. And, you know, I really kind of wanted to make it to where it really wasn't such a polished project. You know, I just kind of wanted to make this, again, hearkening back to sitting in the living room with those older gentlemen learning to play, you know, just that rawness of just putting the mic up and trying to capture it and, you know, hear me breathing and hear a chair kind of, you know, move a little bit or some finger noise, and just try to keep it really organic, which I think, you know, also lends to the, you know, to the trueness of the hymns and the project. So that's kind of how I approached it. You know, there wasn't a lot of thought, you know, as far as trying to make it, you know, a crystal clean, really overproduced project. It's pretty grassroots and hopefully it'll stand on its own.
Yeah.
You know, taking that path, you know, and some of my favorite guitar records are like that, you know, just raw and off the cuff and, you know, just performance based, you know.
Was it easy to whittle down to these tunes that you picked?
Yeah, kind of, sort of, you know, I kind of wanted to go for ones that I just knew, you know. I didn't want to have to kind of like learn anything for it. I just figured, you know, I'll just, you know, kind of start sitting on the couch and, you know, watching TV or whatever, and just jot down things every once in a while that I knew. And pretty soon I had this list of like 15 or 20 and just kind of whittled it down. That was basically the preparation, just things I knew, because I didn't want to, you know, and I learned real quick too. You know, I think other guys that have done this, you know, when you go into a studio and you have somebody on the other side of the glass and, you know, they're running the tape and pushing the buttons and they're taking care of the engineering thing, and you're just playing, that's a beautiful thing. But, you know, when you're trying to do it yourself, mm-hmm. you know, there's, you know, things kind of get heavy pretty quick. You know, it's like, okay, I'm engineering and to the best of my ability and trying to play, you know. So, you know, there, and I think that kind of lent really to kind of scrapping it the first time. It was like, you know, the first time was like a learning curve. I didn't know how to do that, or I didn't know how to do, you know, how to add this effect or how to place this mic, you know. And so the first time was the learning curve. And I think, you know, that's the other thing. I wanted to kind of stay out of my own way, you know, sort of like the old Ronco commercial, set it and forget it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the approach I wanted. It's like, find out what works, you know, and set up the template so it's the same every time, you know, to kind of take the burden off of all the engineering aspects of it, you know, because even recording something basic is, you know, to get a good sound is, you know, can be a challenge at times, you know. And I wasn't in like this huge soundproof room. I was, you know, in my man cave, you know, with some homemade baffles, you know. And I think that's the strength too of, you know, recording gear and equipment and stuff now. It's like, it's so good now that, you know, you can get out, you can get a lot out of just having a few minor things, you know, a good DAW and then a good mic and a good pre, and you can get a lot done with that, you know. So I just wanted to stay out of my way, and I learned a lot about recording, and I got a whole new appreciation for great engineers.
Yeah,
because they, yeah, it's its own thing for sure.
So what recording gear did you actually use? What mic is on this record?
You know, I used some Lewitt stuff. And if you're gonna ask me the model numbers, I don't know, but I can, you know, I can show you if I can see you. And then the system I used, you know, I tried to get friendly with Pro Tools, and I just, you know, I'm not a complicated tech guy, you know, and I don't, was, you know, if it was above my pay grade to figure it out, I don't know. But I ended up going with Studio One by Personas. And what really made that a good program for me is Studio One, it's, you know, it was like easy to use, easy to set up, easy to get a good sound. And then in the mixing and mastering section, you know, they've got it set up to where, like, you know, if you want to do your own project and put it out yourself, you can add ISRC numbers, you can add the artwork, you can add the, you know, the, who wrote the song and all that other stuff. And so when it's ready to, when you master it or send it off to be mastered, you know, they've got it built in to the system that all that stuff is supplied, or you can just do a digital release from Studio One, which I found kind of, you know, really helpful, because it kind of just seems, for guys like me, you know, that are not with an independent label, or, you know, this is a way to get music out there that we can do ourselves and afford to do it, you know. And so, yeah, that's the system I use. And then used a pair of John Hardy mic pre's, and that, again, you know, a pretty simple setup, nothing real fancy.
Nice. And I know this was sort of, in addition to being a love letter to all these songs and hymns, like, this is kind of a love letter to Collings guitars, this whole album. How many did you use on this thing?
Well, I used a Waterloo on a couple. And then, you know, my D1 traditional and OM2 Madagascar traditional, they just worked. And then I used my 1943 LG2 on one.
Okay.
Other than that, those two Collings just worked, and they sounded great. The OM especially, this particular one must have been an early one, because it has a T-bar in the neck. Which they don't have now, you know. And it just felt like an old guitar, and in a microphone, it just performed, you know, like an old Rosewood OM. And so it's like, if that's working, and I love the neck on it, it was like, I'm just going to kind of stick with what works, you know, what I'm getting a good sound with. So yeah, two Collings, a Waterloo, and then the old LG2. That's the one that I had out at the summit. And so, yeah, but that's what I use. I used a Collings tenor guitar on one song. And that was another whole experience. I'm not really a tenor player. And I can see why now.
But how'd you tune
again,
it?
Yeah. How did I tune it? Carefully. I don't remember how I tuned it. It was like, because I remember I had to go online and just ask, you know, find out how do you tune a tenor guitar, you know.
Well, that's a controversial subject, but yeah.
You know, kingdoms have risen and fallen over the tuning of a tenor guitar. And so, but no, I went online and looked and found it. And, you know, it's like a mandolin, you know, I mean, the fingering and the positions are, you know, like a mandolin, which I'm familiar, you know, which I play. So but the thing that got me was the finger stretch. It's like, you know, you're kind of like embarking on, like, you know, to get certain voices and things. It's a whole different deal. And I was familiar with tenor guitar from just, you know, listening to a bunch of, like, you know, Texas fiddle stuff where, you know, the tenor guitar is such a rhythm instrument. So I think, you know, that's why I used it on one. It was like, okay, that's enough. That's enough of a workout. But yeah, you know, so those two colonies, they just worked, you know? And so I wanted to use guitars that worked and sounded great and that I could play. And again, you know, with this, I was just kind of under my own microscope, you know, and the other thing I think I walked away from the project with learning is, you know, recording yourself and listening back is just a really good way to kind of just, you know, improve your skills. You know, we sit there as guitarists and we sit there and we play, and, you know, but when you record, when you sit down and make an effort to record yourself and then listen back, you know, you learn a lot about your playing. So, you know, I think that's another thing I walked away with, this is just trying to learn how to be a better player. You know, there's guys that do a lot of studio work, you know, in town, like Carl Miner, great player, great session guy. Of course, Brian, you know, Brian Sutton, mm-hmm. on everybody's records. But, you know, to put myself under a microscope and go, I'm going to do a solo acoustic record on these hymns that can't really be changed a whole lot. You know, I'm going to try and make the performances as palatable as I can with guitars that I can use over and over on these different songs and not switch up the feel. You know, I guess I was trying to eliminate my eliminate the collateral damage, maybe. But yeah, so that's what I use, and they sounded great.
Yeah, and how can folks find this record?
They can go to a website. That's another thing I'm learning how to do, how to build a website. Wow. That's another whole thing.
Yeah.
They can go to my website.
Yeah.
As you know, it's, and the thing I'm learning about that, it's just maintenance and learning, you know. So they can go to my built so far website, www.minnerguitar.com. It's available there. They can pre-order it. It comes out January 31st. And if this is going to be broadcast after that, they can go there and pick it up. And then I'm eventually going to do a hard copy release. And it'll go to not only iTunes, but they can get it from CD Baby and all those outlets as well.
Awesome. And what's next for you, Bob?
What's that, sir?
What's next for you right now?
The next for me is starting the whole Tim McGraw machine again. And I'm working, I'm contemplating a volume two, but I've also got a bunch of flat picking stuff, some original stuff that I'm wanting to work on, in a slightly bigger context, and call in some people to do maybe a couple of vocals, and so that's kind of what's next for me, you know. And then I'm actually also contemplating doing a clawhammer banjo record.
All right.
Yeah, you know, again, going back to the childhood. Growing up playing clawhammer. So, you know, and again, being able to do it here at the house, that makes it easy. You know, I can get up in my pajamas and make my my Pete's coffee and sit there and get through it. So hopefully by the end of this year, 2019, I have a couple more projects out. And again, I just want to say thank you guys for your support. It's an honor to be associated with Fretboard Journal and everything you guys do. And just thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's great. And it's a great record. I'm happy to help folks find it. So thanks so much, Bob.
Hey, thank you, Jason. So much appreciated.
All right. Till next time.